is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister tells his British counterpart that Tehran seeks action rather than words from the signatories of the 2015 nuclear deal. Palestinian launch a general strike in the occupied city of Bethlehem after the death of a recently released cancer-stricken prisoner. Also coming up, Britain warns its food producers to brace for a 400% rise in the cost of carbon dioxide after gas prices hit record highs in the country. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran has so far not seen any tangible action on the part of the US and Europe regarding halted talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark during a meeting with his British counterpart, Liz Truss, on the sidelines of this week's UN General Assembly in New York. He said the US, with Europe's silence and abetting, continues to impose sanctions on Iran while claiming to return to the agreement. The top Iranian diplomat described the U.S. position as a clear contradiction. He added that the reconstruction of ties between Iran and Britain requires adopting serious measures, stressing that London needs to repay its four-decade-long debt to Iran. Amir Abdullahian also met a number of other foreign diplomats at his first appearance at the General Assembly. Iran's permanent representative to Vienna-based international organizations has criticized a recently announced security pact between the US, the UK, and Australia. Kazim Gharibabadi says London and Washington have imperiled the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the principle of nuclear disarmament by pledging to provide Australia with atomic-powered submarines. He called on the two countries to drop their double standards and stop jeopardizing their non-proliferation commitments under the guise of strategic concerns. Gharibabadi said the US and Britain condemn Iran for enriching uranium at 60% purity, while the submarines they plan to build for Australia would use reactor fuel enriched at more than 90%. He said Canberra must allow safeguards to inspections of all nuclear materials by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Gharibabadi said the IAEA must keep the Board of Governors consistently informed on the matter. Earlier, we asked the author and journalist Daniel Lazar about what he thinks regarding the AUKUS security pact between the US, the UK, and Australia. Here's what he had to say.
I mean, the US has pursued a monstrous double standard throughout this period. You know, it says nothing about the hundreds of nuclear weapons that that Israel possesses. You know, but makes a regards any progress that Iran makes towards even enriching uranium as profoundly unsettling to the Middle East. And the same thing goes for Australia. I mean, giving nuclear technology of the sort to Australia certainly changes the balance of power in the Western Pacific, and it clearly points to the very good possibility that Australia itself might one day acquire nuclear weapons capability. So the U.S. Is just pursuing, you know, two different lines of logic. There's one rule for Iran and other countries like that, and another rule for America's allies.
Palestinians have launched a general strike in the occupied city of Bethlehem over the death of a cancer-stricken Palestinian recently released from an Israeli jail on health grounds. Hossein Masalma was abducted by the Israeli military in 2002 and sentenced to 20 years in prison. While in detention, he had been denied urgently needed medical treatment for his leukemia. The Palestinian Prisoner Society says the Israeli regime is fully responsible for his death, especially since Masalma was subject to medical negligence. Various Palestinian groups have also called for protests across the occupied territories after the funeral on Thursday. Recently, Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have held a number of mass rallies against the Israeli regime's mistreatment of Palestinian inmates. Mona Kadil is our correspondent in the occupied territories and joins us now. Mona, what's the nature of this strike to highlight the prisoners, the Palestinian prisoners who suffer from medical negligence on the part of Israel?
Well, this strike had taken place because Palestinians were angry. First, Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are not having all the rights behind bars. We are speaking about thousands of Palestinians being incarcerated in very difficult situation in the Israeli jails. Hundreds of them are suffering from different and various forms of illness. Some are in serious conditions, like what happened with Hossein Masalma, this Palestinian former prisoner, 39 years old, from Al-Khadr town in Bethlehem. As you have mentioned, he was arrested in 2002 and was sentenced to 20 years. He spent 19 years behind bars because of his serious illness. He was suffering from cancer. Last February, he was released from Israeli jails and he was transferred to one of the Israeli hospitals, and he was in very serious conditions. Then he was transferred to a Palestinian hospital in Ramallah. But all the doctors said that he didn't get the required medications in Israeli jails. That's why they can't save him. He passed away early today. And Palestinians in the village of Al-Khadr, as well as in Bethlehem, are demanding the international community to interfere and save other Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who need immediate medical intervention because of the Israeli authorities continue to impose medical negligence against the Palestinian prisoners. If Palestinians are suffering from anything inside jail, then they would be taken to the prison, nurse, not a doctor, after weeks, and they will give him only pain relievers, nothing more. That's why Hossein Masalma is not the first Palestinian prisoner to pass away, even inside Israeli jail or after his release. The main reason for his death is medical negligence and Israeli authorities' insistence not to give him the appropriate medication.
And many thanks for that, Mona. Mona Kandil there, our correspondent, joining us out of Ramallah. Now, the UK has warned about the food industry, or the UK has warned the food industry, rather, about a sharp rise in carbon dioxide prices after wholesale gas prices soar in the country. Environment Secretary George Eustace said the cost of every tonne of CO2 would rise fivefold to around £1,000. The warning came after London offered tens of millions of dollars to restart production of carbon dioxide at a US-owned plant. The CF Industries was shut recently because of soaring gas prices. The government has warned that some food producers, including poultry plants, would need to close. A leading gas distributor company has also expressed concern that the UK carbon dioxide shortage is spilling over into the rest of Europe. The continent faces a liquefied natural gas crisis as high demand in Asia pushed down supplies to Europe. The Venezuelan president has called for the lifting of sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union on his country. Nicolas Maduro made the remarks in his speech to the United Nations General Assembly. He says sanctions prevent Venezuelan oil and mining companies from selling their products. Maduro denounced what he called permanent systematic aggression waged against Venezuela. Through these restrictions, the Venezuelan president called for the establishment of a new world free of colonialism and imperialism. The chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve has warned that failure to pay government debts would do severe damage to the economy. Jerome Powell called on U.S. lawmakers to raise the nation's borrowing limits urgently. He also warned that the Federal Reserve or anyone else cannot protect the markets or the economy in the event of a failure by the government to pay its debts. However, the opposition leader in the Senate has steadfastly refused to cooperate with the majority-holding Democrats to increase the debt ceiling. Officials have warned that it could lead to chaos in financial markets. Commentator Nicholas Ayala says the ultimate goal of sanctions imposed by imperialist powers is to halt the progress and development in independent countries. That refers to our earlier story regarding Venezuela.
The global issue that we're facing today is an issue of imperialism, of hegemony, specifically Western hegemony. And that is really what's driving a lot of these issues that we see in Cuba and Iran and Venezuela. It's the main force behind the blockades and the sanctions. And we've seen the damage that blockades and sanctions have done in many of these nations. These sanctions, these blockades are evil, or are essentially attacking the progress that many of these nations could make, and in essence stunting their development and their growth. And that's really the goal of these imperialist sanctions.
And going back to our earlier story regarding the chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, who has warned that the failure to pay government debts would do severe damage to the economy, Colin Campbell explains the possible consequences should Congress fail to raise the debt ceiling.
But right now, because we are in such polarized political times, you have Republicans who refuse to help Democrats and authorize the debt ceiling raise. Now, we've seen what happens before when it comes to the U.S. defaulting and not raising the debt ceiling. We've seen our credit rating go down. We've seen national parks close. We've seen outrage coming from some members of the public, some politicians. But altogether, the debt ceiling is usually raised. It's usually part of just what politicians are supposed to be doing. But right now, things are very partisan. Republicans want Democrats to take all the blame for raising the debt ceiling so that they can use it as political fodder in upcoming elections, saying, see, look how much Democrats are spending. They're spending all the money. They're tax and spend liberals. This is costing you taxpayers more money in the end. That's why you need to vote them out of office. It goes on and on and on. Many people expect that the debt ceiling will be raised, and right now it'll be incumbent upon the Democrats to handle this responsibility solely because Republicans will not give them the assist.
staying in the U.S., where a federal judge has reportedly ordered Facebook to hand over records of accounts linked to anti-Rohingya violence in Myanmar that the social networking firm had shut down in 2018. A Wall Street Journal report says the judge in Washington, D.C. also criticized Facebook for refusing to provide details to investigators seeking to prosecute Myanmarese officials for their crimes against the Rohingya. There's no comment yet from Facebook over the ruling. The American multinational technology company had cited U.S. law for its actions, saying electronic communication services are barred from disclosing users' communications. More than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims fled Myanmar following a military-led crackdown in 2017. There were harrowing accounts of killing, torture, and rape of Rohingya men and women. The United Nations says the crackdown was perpetrated with genocidal intentions. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are facing a barrage of detention and vicious expulsion campaigns since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government, which calls them a security threat. But data by the Indian Crime Records Agency shows that Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Manawa Zaman has the details.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threat to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
There is no evidence whatsoever about Rohingyas being involved in anything even close to terrorist activity. This is the paranoia of the Indian deep state, which increasingly wants to do all this fear-mongering to increase its budget.
Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest and stand by its ethos considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. In the limelight.
2 weeks after the 2020 presidential election, a team of lawyers closely allied with Donald Trump held a widely watched news conference at the Republican Party headquarters in Washington. At the event, they laid out a bizarre conspiracy theory claiming that a voting machine company had worked with an election software firm, the financier George Soros, and the Venezuelan government to steal the presidential contest from Donald Trump. But there was a problem for the Trump team, according to court documents released on Monday evening, 20th of September. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times law and criminal justice correspondent Alan Feuer. The piece is titled "Trump Campaign New Lawyers Voting Machine Claims Were Baseless," memo shows. Stay with us for more. Weeks after the 2020 presidential election, a team of lawyers closely allied with Donald Trump held a widely watched news conference at the Republican Party's headquarters in Washington. At the event, they laid out a bizarre conspiracy theory claiming that a voting machine company had worked with an election software firm, the financier George Soros, and the Venezuelan government to steal the presidential contest from Donald Trump. but there was a problem for the Trump team, according to court documents released on Monday evening, 20th of September. By the time the news conference occurred on 19th of November, Donald Trump's campaign had already prepared an internal memo on many of the outlandish claims about the company, Dominion Voting Systems, and a separate software company, Smartmatic. The memo had determined that those allegations were untrue. The court papers, which were initially filed late last week as a motion in a defamation lawsuit brought against the campaign and others by a former Dominion employee, Eric Coomer, contain evidence that officials in the Trump campaign were aware early on that many of the claims against the companies were baseless. The documents also suggest that the campaign sat on its findings about Dominion, even as Sidney Powell and other lawyers attacked the company in the conservative media and ultimately filed four federal lawsuits accusing it of a vast conspiracy to rig the election against Donald Trump. According to emails contained in the documents, Zach Parkinson, then the campaign's deputy director of communications, reached out to subordinates on 13th of November, asking them to substantiate or debunk several matters concerning Dominion. The next day, the emails show Zach Parkinson received a copy of a memo cobbled together by his staff from what largely appeared to be news articles and public fact-checking services. Even though the memo was hastily assembled, it rebutted a series of allegations that Sidney Powell and other lawyers were making in public. It found that Dominion Voting Systems did not use voting technology from the software company Smartmatic in the 2020 election. That Dominion Voting Systems had no direct ties to Venezuela or to George Soros. And that there was no evidence that Dominion's leadership had connections to left-wing Antifa activists, as Sidney Powell and other lawyers had claimed. As Mr. Coomer's lawyers wrote in their motion in the defamation lawsuit, the memo produced by the Trump campaign shows that, at least internally, the Trump campaign found there was no evidence to support the conspiracy theories regarding Dominion voting systems and Eric Coomer. Even at that time, many political observers and voters, Democratic and Republican alike, dismissed the efforts by Sidney Powell and other pro-Trump lawyers like Rudolph Giuliani as a wild last-ditch attempt to appease a defeated president in denial of his loss. But the false theories they spread quickly gained currency in the conservative media and endure nearly a year later. It is unclear if Donald Trump knew about or saw the memo. Still, the documents suggest that his campaign's communication staff remained silent about what it knew of the claims against Dominion at a moment when the allegations were circulating freely. The Trump campaign continued to allow its agents, the motion says, to advance debunked conspiracy theories and defame Eric Coomer, apparently without providing them with their own research debunking those theories. Mr. Coomer, Dominion's one-time director of product strategy and security, sued Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani, and the Trump campaign, and others last year in state district court in Denver, Colorado. He has said that after the election, he was wrongly accused by a right-wing podcast host of hacking his company's systems to ensure Donald Trump's defeat, and of then telling left-wing activists that he had done so. Soon after the host, Joe Altman, made these accusations, they were seized upon and amplified by Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani, who were part of a self-described elite strike force of lawyers leading the charge in challenging Joseph Biden Jr.'s victory. On 19th of November, for example, Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani appeared together at a news conference at the Republican National Committee headquarters and placed Mr. Coomer at the center of a plot to hijack the election by hacking Dominion's voting machines. By Ms. Powell's account that day, the conspiracy included Smartmatic, Venezuelan officials, people connected to George Soros, and a massive influence of communist money. Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani did not respond to messages seeking comment on the documents. Representatives of Donald Trump also did not respond to emails seeking comment. Donald Trump continues to falsely argue that the election was stolen from him, and in recent months, Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani have struck by their claims that the election was rife with fraud. A lawyer for Mr. Giuliani said in a court filing last month that at least some of his claims of election fraud were substantially true. And as recently as 3 weeks ago, Sidney Powell told a reporter for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the 2020 election was essentially a bloodless coup, where they took over the presidency of the United States without a single shot being fired. It remains unclear how widely the memo was circulated among Trump campaign staff members. According to the court documents, Rudy Giuliani said in a deposition that he had not seen the memo before he gave his presentation in Washington, and he questioned the motives of those who had prepared it. They wanted Trump to lose because they could raise more money, Mr. Giuliani was quoted as saying in the deposition. But at the time that the internal report was prepared, Mr. Giuliani and Ms. Powell were both active supervisors, as he put it, in his deposition, in the Trump campaign's broader plan to challenge the election results, an effort that eventually included more than 60 failed lawsuits filed across the country. While Sidney Powell soon went her own way in claiming that Dominion had conspired to steal the election, Rudy Giuliani continued working closely with Donald Trump and his campaign, ultimately changing strategies and seeking to persuade state legislatures to overturn the popular vote. The motion notes that the lines were blurred as to whom Sidney Powell was working for at the time, herself, her non-profit organization, or the Trump campaign. Almost immediately after she prompted the conspiracy theory about Dominion at a news conference in November, Donald Trump sought to distance himself from her. But by December, as Trump's legal options narrowed, the former president considered bringing her back into the fold and discussed whether to appoint her as a special counsel overseeing an investigation of voter fraud.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
It is difficult to think of an event that so profoundly transformed the US public opinion across so many dimensions as the 9/11 attacks. Patriotic sentiment surged in the aftermath of 9/11, after the US and its allies launched airstrikes against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in early October 2001, 79% of adults said they had displayed an American flag. A year later, 62% of Americans said they had often felt patriotic as a result of the 9/11 attacks. Moreover, the public largely set aside political differences and rallied in support of the nation's major institutions as well as its political leadership. But this unity and all those patriotic sentiments had a dark side as well. After the September 11th attacks, Muslims, especially American Muslims, experienced a kind of intense scrutiny and distrust that was unleashed after the attacks, a rare phenomenon to that time. American Muslims compose 1.1% of America's population. After 9/11, they faced physical assault, emotional abuse, and other forms of mistreatment. In the meantime, there was this often politicized conversation about real Islam, which has created a toxic environment for American Muslims ever since. Although most Americans did not contribute to the idea that there is something inherently bad about Islam, there were enough voices of hate, deliberate misinformation, and genuine misunderstandings to create a powerful message. Muslims are not to be trusted.
What the government did here is a clear case of profiling, ethnic and religious profiling, which is antithetical to core American values and which is never okay. The plaintiffs and dozens of others were stopped because they were Muslim, and they were stopped because they attended the conference. And they were the victims, once again, of our government's overzealous and counterproductive ethnic and religious profiling in the name of national security. But this did nothing to make us safer, and it did everything to undermine our rights.
Unfortunately, again, it seems that in the post-9/11 world that we live in today, American Muslims are guilty until proven innocent.
In a September 2001 survey, 28% of American adults said they had grown more suspicious of people of Middle Eastern descent. That grew to 36% less than a year later. Republicans, in particular, increasingly came to associate Muslims and Islam with violence. Within the next few years, most Republicans and GOP leaners said Islam was more likely than other religions to encourage violence. Based on a recent survey conducted in August 2021, 72% of Republicans expressed this view. Many believe that the division in American society was at its highest level during Donald Trump's presidency. But the fact is, since the 9/11 attacks, divisions in American society have deepened amid changes wrought by the technology and media revolution, the weaponization of misinformation, and foreign policy choices. In other words, Muslims, like other minorities in the US, have become caught up in the sometimes bitter national conversation about history, race, religion, ethnicity, and heritage.
During these difficult times, as Americans, we will not succumb to racism. We will not allow ourselves to be divided and succumb to Islamophobia. And when hundreds of thousands of people have lost everything, have nothing left but the shirts on their backs, we will not turn our backs on the refugees from Syria and Afghanistan.
Anti-Muslim political rhetoric and policies, as well as far-right ideology in the United States, have grown through the financing, organizing, and networking of those who do not want an inclusive country. The United States sought to debunk the Al-Qaeda narrative that the West is at war with Islam, in part through global outreach to Muslims, both via governments and at the community level. At the same time, Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and his recruiters across the globe used U.S. foreign policy choices as proof of American hostility toward Muslims.
We're talking about 9/11. It's like now 20 years. Feeling unsafe is the same results among Muslim Arab American. So it's really like, you know, when we say lack of safety, they also has to do with lack of trust, you know, in the government and the leaders, you know, around them. Because every year a leader comes and promises a lot of things, you know, to do against racism, against discrimination. But if you look around, you know, we are still having the same issue.
The U.S.-led wars in Afghanistan and Iraq helped feed this narrative that America seeks to destroy Muslims. Other activities related to the U.S. so-called global war on terrorism had the same effect. For example, massive drone strikes in Somalia, Yemen, and Pakistan that mostly resulted in civilian casualties. The widely distributed images of Iraqi prisoners abused at Abu Ghraib, as well as drone strikes and other ongoing controversies surrounding the Guantanamo Bay prison, served to ignite anger and outrage. This has helped many terrorist organizations such as Daesh and others to use these images to recruit members. The United States tried to find a way to build new connections with Muslim communities. Washington sought to find common purpose and build networks of like-minded thinkers that were united in the interest of protecting young people from being lured into a terrorist group that claimed to represent the so-called real Muslims. Critically, Muslims all over the world were eager to push back against terrorist organizations trying to radicalize and recruit their youth. So, U.S. officials created new coalitions of civil society partners, such as Generation Change, a global network of youth changemakers with 30 international chapters that advanced local initiatives to reject the appeal of extremist narratives. In line with the same effort, in 2009, then-U.S. President Barack Obama made a speech in Cairo. He tried to show that the Obama administration was genuinely committed to building partnerships with Muslims based on mutual interest and respect. The speech amplified the importance of Islam's history, its vast and diverse practices, and the profound impact Muslims have made to science, philosophy, and culture. It also rejected the idea that Islam is synonymous with terrorism. Over the course of Obama's two terms, the efforts related to the engagement strategy were ramped up with new programs and initiatives. However, while Obama made such speeches, drone attacks in Muslim countries continued. His decisions, which affected Muslim lives, made it difficult for many to believe that America is friends with Islam.
When most of the victims of U.S. drone attacks are Afghan civilians, including women and children, then we cannot call this tactic an effective measure in the fight against militants.
Perhaps it was the American Muslims that made the real change. Amid a rise in hate crimes against minorities, American Muslims, through non-governmental organizations, community groups, and other civic organizations, have found allies and built new relationships. Civil society and religious leaders have polished their advocacy, while philanthropists are finally turning their attention to issues of hate and extremism. American Muslims have found new agency and organizations to use art, culture, and policy as vehicles to repair societies and build understanding. The importance of listening to diverse civil society voices, engaging with local and national leaders, and creating new bridges have activated many Muslim and non-Muslim Americans. More should be done, but there are improvements in the way non-Muslims talk about Islam today, as well as in the dialogue about ensuring inclusive societies.
Limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden and Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison have welcomed their new security ties after last week's announcement that Washington would provide Canberra with advanced technology for nuclear-powered submarines as part of a trilateral deal with the United Kingdom. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter. The piece is titled, U.S. has no closer ally than Australia, Biden says after AUKUS pact. U.S. President Joe Biden and Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison have welcomed their new security ties after last week's announcement that Washington would provide Canberra with advanced technology for nuclear-powered submarines as part of a trilateral deal with the United Kingdom. The United States has no closer or more reliable ally than Australia, Biden said on Tuesday, 21st of September, ahead of a bilateral meeting with Scott Morrison on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. In his speech to the General Assembly earlier, Joe Biden made no direct reference to the controversial new security pact under which the United States agreed to share nuclear propulsion technology for submarines in a move that is designed to contain China. The deal has infuriated Paris, and Joe Biden has yet to be able to arrange a call with the seething French President Emmanuel Macron. Scott Morrison, meanwhile, has been accused of going behind the backs of the French to cancel a contract with Paris to supply 12 submarines and replacing it with a deal for nuclear-powered submarines with the United States and Britain. On Tuesday, 21st of September, Scott Morrison came under a ferocious attack by the former Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, who, writing in Le Monde, said the Prime Minister had behaved in a cavalier manner that would play into the hands of China propagandists. Kevin Rudd accused Scott Morrison of not following basic diplomatic protocol by failing to inform the French government of his decision. Such a failure is not acceptable between adversaries. It is even less so between allies. Besides, Morrison failed to understand the wider implications of his decision for foreign policy, and this is perhaps the most appalling of the whole story, he said. The attack came as Emmanuel Macron made his first moves in response to the snub, speaking on Tuesday with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in what appeared to be an effort to shore up a rival Indian-French alliance in the Indo-Pacific and secure a pending profitable nuclear deal. The two leaders had vowed to act jointly in the Indo-Pacific region, the French presidency said. French President Emmanuel Macron was said to have assured India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi of continued commitment to strengthening of India's strategic autonomy, including its industry and technology base, as part of a close relationship based on trust and mutual respect. France has been bidding for a $7 billion contract to build 6 nuclear-powered submarines for India. Emmanuel Macron's office said that the shared approach of the two countries within the framework of the Euro-Indian relationship aims to promote regional stability and the rule of law, while ruling out any form of hegemony. The phone call looked like a potential French effort to shore up its bid for SSN submarines and even assemble a separate alliance to the AUKUS security pact announced last week. Naval Group, the French business cut out of the Australian deal, has already been working with India's state-owned Mazagon Dock Shipbuilders to deliver 6 Cavalry submarines that are valued at a combined 230 billion rupees, that is $3.13 billion. Two of these have already been launched. Two submarines are undergoing sea trials and two are under construction. The project includes technology transfers from the French company Naval Group to its Indian partners. The French Defense Minister Florence Parly and her Indian counterpart Rajnath Singh held discussions about a Naval Group bid for tenders launched in June by the Indian Navy for Project 76, indigenous SSNs fitted with a new nuclear reactor. The United States has so far refused to share the technology with India, although it now has agreed to do so with Australia. New Delhi wants the submarines because it is worried about the rise of China, whose military ships are increasing joint exercises with the Pakistani Navy in the Indian Ocean. In 2017, the Indian Navy Chief, Admiral Sunil Lamba, visited a French shipyard for a closer look at its newest Barracuda-class SSN submarines. However, it has also sent out feelers to the United States for nuclear reactor propulsion technology for submarines and surface ships. Emmanuel Macron's call with Narendra Modi came as French opposition politicians criticized him for missing the scale of the threat to the Australian contract. Modi is preparing to travel to the United States to meet with Joe Biden for their first in-person bilateral summit on Thursday. Narendra Modi is also expected to have bilateral conversations with Scott Morrison and the Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. On Friday, the four leaders will sit down at the White House for the first summit of the Quadrilateral Forum, or the Quad. The four leaders met digitally in March of this year. India has expressed concern that the AUKUS partnership could mean a downgrading for the Quadrilateral Forum.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady here from IRRB English Radio. In the studio, as always, I have the pleasure and honor of having my lovely sister and friend and wonderful guest, Sister Razia Shamli. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam, my dear friend.
Thank you so very much for joining us. We've been discussing some examples in the blessed life of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam regarding his self-care routine and the precise, intricate attention he paid to all the details, whether it was regarding his hair, his skin, his aroma, his
personal hygiene.
So important. And it just comes to show that Islam is such a multifaceted religion. And it's not just a stringent list of do's and don'ts. Otherwise, you'll burn in hell for all of eternity. It's a lifestyle, you know?
You know, this hadith that says, if you spend one dirham for henna, it's like, it's even more than giving money for charity. It's like, I couldn't believe it myself that Islam gives so much attention to your
physical appearance.
To your physical appearance. And because it just doesn't affect you as a person, but it affects you and your relationship with your spouse, your relationship with your friends, your relationship with the whole society. So it's like it has like extended rays of influence everywhere.
So Muslim ladies out there, you have no excuse not to be fabulous.
Exactly.
Take really good care of yourselves and don't even look at it as luxury or indulgence. It's your God-given right. In fact, it's your duty to try to maintain your beauty and your youth, because it affects you, it affects your mentality, it affects your husband, it affects your children. It is a form of women's empowerment when your daughter sees at home how pretty mommy is, how mommy smells good all the time, how daddy's always saying to mommy that she's beautiful, she's like a queen. I want to grow up and be like mommy.
Instead of
grow up and be like that random supermodel.
Exactly. This is very beautiful that you just mentioned. I want to today talk about, actually, the Noble Prophet had a routine for certain things that he did. For example, for his bedtime routine, he applied with collyrium. Mm. Collyrium, I think it's a kind of, it was a medicine that was used for the eye. And someplace I saw collyrium being used interchangeably. These days when they're making kohl, they take nuts, they burn them, and the powder, the ashes of those nuts, they use it as kohl for the eyes.
Oh, so it's some sort of like natural eyeliner.
Exactly, natural eyeliner.
But I believe you're supposed to apply it inside the eyes rather than on the external. Okay.
And it's interesting that these days women, using kohl is something that women usually do.
But back then men did it too. Interesting. In some regions men still do it, especially the subcontinent.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Indian, Pakistani men, Afghan men, I've seen a lot of them still applying.
So the Prophet used to do it every single night before going to bed.
Oh, so while he shuts his eyes,
it
all
gets
those properties
goes inside and, you know, gets absorbed by the body.
Okay.
And the miswak, you know, it was a kind of plant that
basically,
natural brush.
Yeah, it's the natural toothbrush, which is surprisingly been trending so much in the Western world lately.
They're actually selling it in herbal shops.
Exactly. 1400 years ago, our prophet was totally rocking it.
Right.
And it looks, you know, harmless enough. It looks like a piece of stick, but it's a very specific type, species of wood, and it has a slight scent, and it's constantly damp, unlike other sticks that once removed from their roots, they dry out.
I think I once watched a YouTube video about how to use the miswak, and you have to go through a procedure so that that stick would be applicable,
ready
for use, right?
Mm.
But back then, and even now, it's become very trendy.
And the cool part about it is you don't need to apply toothpaste on it anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. It has natural toothpaste. So these two were part of the bedtime routine of the Prophet. And I want to talk about one specific thing that the Prophet liked a lot in his life. And there are a hadith that says that when this kind of gift was given to the Prophet, he never refused it, and he immediately used it, and he gave some compliment about it.
Wow, what is it?
Perfume. He loved perfume, and everybody knew.
We're going to go on a short break, and we're going to be right back, so don't go anywhere. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Muslim Lady, and we are discussing the importance of self.